Okay. Good morning or noon, everyone. Nice to see all of you here. Do we have enough chairs? Almost. I was expecting that it would be a bit borderline. There's no more chairs there, right? Yes. Someone needs to be kicked out. Oh, just a second. Kan jeg stjele to stoler av dere? Kjempebra. Did you hear me when I was over there? So if I go to the bathroom with this on, then let's try that later. Yes. Okay, welcome to this course, which is called Infrastructure as Code. And my name is Erik Hjelmås. You will see my contact information here, my email address and my phone number, and my office is A117, which is in the corner over there. I have no specific office hours, so just come by anytime you feel like. You might find me there, and if I'm not there, my colleague Egil is probably there, and he basically know everything that I know and more. So just ask him if I'm not there. I'm usually in my office between 9 and 2 every day. But I try to answer email and SMS messages quite quickly, so just contact me by that if you want to. We have switched rooms from K113 to A46. So, because I'm happy to say that the recording facilities suddenly became available in this room, and it's not in K113, so that's why we moved here, because then I can record the lectures. But this is the first time we're using this equipment in this room, so we'll see how this recording ends up. Schedule in time edits. We have 2 hours here every Thursday from 10 to 12. Well, almost. Sometimes we only have 1 hour. But then we have the lab also in here every Friday between 10 and 2. And my plan is to record all the Thursday sessions. And also, if I ad hoc decide to lecture about something on a Friday, then I will try to remember to record that as well. But I hope you still show up. It's not very motivating to lecture to an empty room. This course is sort of a flipped classroom, meaning, as you may have noticed by my going a bit back and forth and thinking about what I'm going to say, I haven't prepared any lectures, and I'm not going to. So I spend all my time preparing your exercises, and this course is about practical work, and the plan for the lectures is basically to cover anything you want me to cover, to go through the exercises and help you out and see where you have problems. So I lecture sort of on a need basis. Topics are decided a bit when we need them. And then, because most of the things we're going to learn, other people have already lectured much better than me. So I've spent quite some time, and I'm still working on it, which is why this setup is not completely finalized yet, that there are lectures, but given by other people. So please watch the videos as they appear here. So you have readings to do, you have lectures here. In addition, of course, you will, the lectures that we record, you will find at this location. And the setup here is, if there's parentheses, that's a useful resource, and but not considered mandatory. If it's not parentheses, then it's absolutely mandatory. You should watch it. So I put parentheses around this because you should watch an introduction to OpenStack orchestration, but this video is really boring. So I hope to find something better to put in non-parentheses. So that's the setup. These are the topics we'll cover. Just some tools and technologies, what we'll do. These are the readings for every week. And here are the video lectures you should watch. There are some more that will pop up there. Yes. So this course is about practical work. This course used to be called System Administration, and used to have a different format. I started teaching this 15 years ago. I started doing what everyone else does, that I have a textbook and System Administration. We try to do that more practical than other courses. So we have a textbook that describes the bigger picture, and then we do some little pieces here and there. Install some software and upgrade it and do some automatic deployment, so very simple. But I don't think that's the way to go after doing that for 10 years. It's because when we have a chance now to not try to learn the big picture, but to actually do the big picture. And that's the goal of this course. So that's why I threw out the lectures and just put all effort into creating a lab exercise and a course setup, which is a practical work that you will do, and thereby you should learn how to do professional system administration as of 2016. That's the goal with this course. So there will be a document or two documents I've prepared for the first 5 weeks, and I'm almost done with the second part. So we have these 10 weeks which are sort of standard coursework. We have 10 weeks, and then you have 3 weeks of doing a project, which hopefully should then be based on what you've learned in the first 10 weeks. This project counts 1/3 of your grade, because you will have an exam already in October. So we have a midterm exam, which is 1/3 of your grade, which is a 2-hour exam, closed book, no aids. So 2-hour exam in the midterm in early October. And then you have the project, and then you have final exam, which is also 2 hours closed book. And for these 10 weeks, you should do the lab exercises. Some of these are maybe not that much work, but some are probably more work than 1 week. So don't feel locked down that you only have to do this week's exercise and then stop. If you have time left, make sure you read into next week's exercise. And also, if you lag behind, it's not a problem. Just work on the exercises 2 weeks ago and ask me for help on the Friday anyway. I mean, I will help you even though you're working with the beginning material and we're late in the course. It's not, so don't worry about that. Some of you might have a lot of things to do outside your studies now in the beginning and have more time later, and then it's no problem if you go back and start from the beginning. So, but these lab exercises, I call them lab exercises because it's pretty much copy and paste. You don't have to solve anything. You just have to keep up. So everything you have to do, all commands you have to write, everything is in there. So there are no questions that you really have to figure out or think. This should be just do it. But you have to adapt it to your environment. So you have to keep an overview. What is my IP addresses? And replace them in the commands and in the scripts, etc. You have to create some passwords to use for some services, which should be unique for you, etc. So, but what I've done from last year to this year, last year I mixed this. Now I've separated this to be very clear that all the lab exercises, there are no solution documents for that. All the solutions are included. So this should be straightforward. This is what you do to learn all the basics you need. Then there are review questions and problems. These are problems that you should solve. This is what prepares you for the exams. Okay? So this first 5 weeks here should hopefully be published before Monday. And the final two documents within a week or two. Any questions? Feel free to ask questions anytime. Okay. Most of the things in my checklist. So, the thinking behind this course is best described in this blog post, which you should read. And he says that maybe you've heard the terms programmable infrastructure and infrastructure as code, which is, then you understand why I've chosen to call this programmerbar infrastruktur in Norwegian and infrastructure as code in English, because that's the most widely used term internationally. But if you Google infrastruktur som kode, that's not very widely used in Norway, but we use more programmerbar infrastruktur. So this course is part of the DevOps movement with a focus on ops operations. So IT systems of today should be characterized by the fact that development and operations should not be separated, and neither security. So preferably, I would like that we say SecDevOps, because security, it's always been this. Has anyone here read the Phoenix Project? Ah, excellent. So I recommend that. It's a very good novel to read. Read it over a weekend, and it sort of explains the classical, traditional conflict between the developer who wants to just finish a product throw it over to the system administrator, who has to get it into production and try to get it to work, and then with the security guy trying to enforce all kinds of policies to make sure it's impossible to get this thing to work, you know. So this is the traditional old-style way that IT systems work, and the situation you may still encounter when you start working. So it shouldn't be like this. Developers should think security from day one, security by design, and they should not be able to just throw their application over to the system administrator. The system administrator should be part of the process, and they should work together. And both parties should think security. It should not never be an add-on, it should be an integrated part of the process. And the reason that this is much easier and this is happening now is because the system administrator's infrastructure is code. You can be a perfectly good system administrator today, making much more than $100,000, if you will, without ever touching hardware. That's the wonderful world of the cloud. Still no questions. Okay. The second part of this hour, I thought basically that we would just watch a video. By the way, you may have noticed that I speak English, or try to. So I encourage you also to ask questions in English, but but feel free to ask in Norwegian as well, or any other language that I maybe understand, but it's probably not very likely, other than English and Norwegian. But if you ask a question in Norwegian, then I'll just repeat it in English. The important part is that this fact that I speak English should not, or the course is in English, should not stop you from asking questions. And I hope that you hear that my Tor Heyerdahl English should at least not scare you for speaking. Yes. The exams, you can, midterm and final exam, you can answer in either English or Norwegian. The project, you should all write in English. Okay. I thought we could watch this user story. So we're going to use OpenStack. And OpenStack is a cloud that's become extremely popular. Those of you who have completed the course Database Applikasjonsdrift, which is probably half of you, or no, one third of you, took the course with Kyrre Begnum this spring semester. And they, you have already used this cloud in his course. And by the way, prerequisites for this course is, I assume that you have taken a course in operating systems. We don't really need a lot of the theory in operating systems. I also assume that you have either taken this course, Database and Applikasjonsdrift, which is a very practical course where you have to manage some servers. But it's no, if you haven't taken this course, which I know that many of you haven't, I expect that you are proficient in using Linux, especially that you, if you aren't, then you have to be prepared to work quite hard the first few weeks to be comfortable with using Linux command line. Because that's what we're doing all the time. We're going to use Windows later in the course as well. But there will be a lot of Linux usage, so command line usage, piping, checking log messages, many of these things is what we'll do. Okay, but let's watch a video, and for the viewers online, I'm sorry, but the sound from my laptop is not transferring over HDMI. Of course, I can solve this by simply switching to VGA now, probably. That would, let me try to do that, because then we get the sound on the... It's worse now, but it doesn't matter. By the way, my plan is, I say my plan is, and I hope to do it, I will, by each video, I will publish some notes which will mention exactly what parts of the video are really important. So there will be some videos that are 1.5 hour. And then there are some key points in that video that I really want you to watch. And I'll try to publish notes that state this. Let's see if there's sound now.
Next up to talk about even bigger thoughts is Tim Bell, who runs infrastructure for CERN. So I'm very pleased to bring out Tim Bell. Tell us what CERN's doing.
Thanks, Mark.
Bonjour à tous et à toutes.
So this is, it's a bit of introduction in general about CERN, not only directly relevant for this course, but he will go on and tell us how they use OpenStack and how this is transforming IT operations at CERN. So it's 20 minutes. Let's watch this.
Thanks a lot for having a chance to talk to you about CERN's experiences as we move towards an environment around OpenStack. People often describe this as a journey. Many of the user stories describe it in these terms. And it is really a cultural and technology transformation. So what is CERN? CERN is the Centre Européen de Recherche Nucléaire. We're an organization that supports 11,000 physicists from around the world, another worldwide collaboration taking on difficult problems. And these scientists use the facilities at CERN in order to understand the universe. So this is basic research. What is the universe made of? How does it work? There are, however, spin-offs that come from this. Many of you with smartphones will be using capacitive touchscreens invented at CERN in the 1970s. The World Wide Web in the 1990s, but it's not the focus of the work we do. So what do physicists worry about when they wake up in the morning? We had a great event in 2012 in July, where two of the major experiments at CERN, CMS and ATLAS, stood up and independently, without talking to each other at all, produced a fundamental particle, the Higgs boson, with the same mass. This, therefore, accounts as a scientific confirmation, and it's been described as being the equivalent of landing a man on the moon. At the same time, on the personal side, Professor Higgs and Professor Englert, who in the 1960s had come up with these ideas, were able to then go to Stockholm to collect the Nobel Prize in 2013. So this is 50 years between an idea to actually confirming that as a result. However, we're not finished yet. There are some major concerns that we have around the universe, what it's made of, what does the standard models look like to describe how the particles fit together. Amongst the things we're puzzled about is, why don't we have more antimatter? So the universe started off with a big bang, lots of energy. We ought to have equal amounts of matter and antimatter. Luckily, we are largely matter. There is some antimatter out there, but it's really very small. So we participate in various experiments, such as this one attached onto the International Space Station, which, being outside of the Earth's atmosphere, can observe antimatter particles coming in from outer space. But there are other problems we're facing. We've lost 95% of the universe. So when we look at the planets and stars and how they move and how the universe expands, we know that the universe should be a certain mass. However, when we actually count the planets and the stars, we see that we've only got 5%. There's something out there, dark matter, dark energy, which has to be present to describe why the cosmos moves as it does. Looking out into future discoveries, there's some really interesting questions about gravity. We can describe three of the other forces very well with the standard model that the Higgs has confirmed as part of the jigsaw, but gravity is a real problem. We suspect there are particles called gravitons, and we suspect that these briefly appear in our part of the universe, the four dimensions that we perceive, but then could potentially be moving into other dimensions, a bit like if you're on a tightrope, you saw an ant, and then the ant disappeared as it walked around the other side of the tightrope. So as we move the LHC further on, we hope to be able to discover some of these particles and understand the universe further. So when we're faced with a problem such as this, how do we solve it? The first thing to do is to bring together a large community. And then the second thing to do is to design experiments. The LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, was conceived in the 1980s. At the time, a huge number of technology problems were confronting us. But we chose to set off on a path to build a 27-kilometer ring 100 meters underground, straddling the border between France and Switzerland, in order that we'd eventually get to a point where we could construct these experiments. If you ever get a chance to around 80,000 people come over to an open day at CERN in 2013, then what you'd see is you'd see these blue pipes. They are actually surrounded by magnets, and inside there are 2 1-centimeter tubes. The magnets themselves are cooled down to minus 271 degrees centigrade, so 2 degrees above absolute zero. And the tubes inside have a vacuum which is 10 times less dense than on the Moon. And in those tubes, we send round protons, hydrogen nuclei, in 2 directions. And at 4 places around the ring, we cross the beams. When we cross the beams, they're at the 4 detectors. These detectors can be viewed as digital cameras. The slight difference between this and your standard Instamatic is that these ones are roughly the height of Notre Dame. They weigh about the same as the Eiffel Tower, 7,000 tons. They're 100-megapixel cameras, and they take 40 million pictures a second. That creates, amongst other things, some great pictures. It also creates 1 petabyte a second of data. So, to handle this, we have massive computer farms 100 meters underground, filtering this data down to levels that we can record, looking for things that we know are the patterns of the physics that we want to investigate. However, we then have to record this data and analyze it in detail. So how do we do this? In 2014, we've had the CERN Computer Center. We've got around 100 petabytes of data, primarily stored on tape. And we're currently recording our last year of running, before we started the upgrade of the LHC to higher energy, around 27 petabytes a year. 11,000 servers, 75,000 disk drives. We've got some people who are pretty busy doing disk drive swapping. Looking out to 2015, we're going to be doubling the accelerator energy. This will certainly lead to a significant increase in data rate. However, as always, we look forward further than that. And when we look at the plans for how we can use the LHC and increase the energy, we're looking at 400 petabytes a year in 2023. The compute power is likely to be around 50 times more powerful need than what we have at the moment. So with that prospect, then we clearly have to have a computer environment which is reasonably flexible to be able to address these kind of needs and to be able to perform the computing necessary for the physics. So in the Geneva Data Center, we have a nice data center. It used to have 1 mainframe, it used to have 1 cray, and it was great. It's got a raised floor you can walk around underneath. However, when you put in standard industry servers now, you can only put in a small number. People ask, when are we going to fill up the rest of the racks? And we just can't. 6 kilowatts per square meter is the maximum that we can cool in this environment. For those of you that are interested, actually the CERN Center is on Google Street View, so you can go down and wander around. It had about 25,000 people through as tourists last year. So it's actually a tourist attraction. Since the facilities are paid for by the people of Europe, it's only fair that they should also be allowed to come along and see what we're using the money for. The center itself we tend to call the Geneva Data Center, but actually it's in France. So we're just over the border. And when I say just, CERN is an international organization. So the data center and my office are over the border. And I then walk 50 meters over to the restaurant the other side to get my cup of coffee, which is a Swiss cup of coffee. However, just a center in France isn't all that we're needing in order to address these requirements. Clearly, we are at a point where upgrading that data center would have been a significant investment. So instead, what we looked to do was to expand the computing facilities using other member states' facilities. So we asked the countries contributing to CERN to propose to us a data center location. And Budapest in Hungary was chosen. We have 200 gigabit line connections between the two sites. So clearly, we were rather interested in the discussions around internet tax in Hungary, since that would have caused us a significant cost. So the good news is that we've got a new data center. The physicists are pleased because they've got possibility of additional computing resources. The bad news is that in today's economic times, we can't be asking for more staff. Equally, given that we want to scale out the computing, we have to make sure we use the resources we've got to the maximum. We have legacy tools that we wrote 10 years ago that we use to manage the data center. For those of you that are used to looking after 100,000 lines of Perl, it's not something you get up early in the morning for and come into work. And the user expectations are being set by public cloud services. They don't want to fill out service tickets. They don't want to wait weeks while machines are provisioned and cabled up for them. They want to click on the interface, get a cup of coffee, and come back to a working system. So how could internal IT be providing them these kind of facilities? So what we did was to challenge some of the fundamental principles of an organization such as CERN. We're a research organization from the physics point of view, but from a computing point of view, we're actually no longer leading edge. There are many other organizations running at scales beyond the size that we are. So we shouldn't need to do things that are special. We shouldn't be producing custom requirements lists that then mean we have to produce custom solutions.
This is one of the key points. Because traditionally, people develop their own systems. They keep their operations internal. And CERN, which used to be state of the art and doing things that no one else were doing, they're not biggest now. You know, you have Facebook, Google. How much data do Facebook and Google have to manage? And they start sharing what they do. They put their code on GitHub. Everyone does. So that's what he's saying, is that we should stop doing everything internally and create all our own stuff. Let's start sharing and reusing and contributing to existing projects. This is a big change over the last 10 years.
We need to be addressing the staffing question. People are assumed to the situation where you get double computing capacity every 18 months. People, on the other hand, it's actually quite difficult to even maintain the level as technical debt accumulates and they're therefore needing to maintain as well as advance. At the same time, culturally, we wanted to find open source communities. It's very much in the culture of the organization to be contributing to open source. And we wanted to learn from them and equally be able to contribute back those areas that we felt were of general interest, but above all, use those communities also to execute cultural change within CERN. So what do? We sat down for a few weeks.
Of course, you'll recognize that these are most of the tools that you will use in this course as well.
We did a lot of prototyping, and we selected a tool chain. around these areas, so Puppet for configuration management, Kibana Elasticsearch for monitoring, Ceph for storage, and then the key part of this was OpenStack using the RDO distribution in order to be able to bring a flexible and agile cloud to our users. So where are we now? We started off with what was pretty much a research project in 2011 with Cactus. For those of you that tried, it was an interesting experience. But it was already clear that the rate of maturity of the software was going to exceed the speed with which we could be getting our organization ready for production. So we started the investment, started doing the tooling necessary, the training necessary, and in 2013, in July, we went into production with the Grizzly release. By production, I mean when someone creates a virtual machine, we promise we will maintain an environment with that virtual machine in the future. We currently actually have four Icehouse clouds at CERN. So the main CERN one is actually 75,000 cores, because while I've been away traveling for the last week, the guys have installed another 5,000 cores behind me, and I didn't have time to update the slides. We've got three other instances at CERN, those large computer farms I talked about next door to the accelerator. The accelerator's being upgraded. Those farms are idle. So what did the guys do? They've spun up OpenStack, 45,000 additional cores, 100 meters underground, in order to be able to deliver additional simulation capacity for the physicists. Current outlook, we have about 2,000 additional servers on order, and we'll be hitting probably 150,000 cores in total on the site between CERN and Budapest by the first quarter 2015. All code that we've written that is of any interest to the community, we have submitted upstream. All the code we feel is not of interest is in GitHub under the CERNOps Git repository. People are welcome to browse it and see if it is of interest. So, the two areas that we've looked at in detail are Nova cells. This allows us to scale to the sort of size we're talking about and also to be looking out as we look at the challenges come 2023. This allows you to build up small units of OpenStack and assemble them together into what appears to the end user to be a single homogeneous resource. And this allowed us to simplify the end user experience for the end user while still allowing us to scale out the underlying environment. We have cells in Geneva, cells in Budapest, and we have a set of front-end servers that arrange to direct the work appropriately and schedule it. At the same time, we're facing another set of challenges, which is we're seeing a large number of OpenStack clouds appearing. Along with the four I talked about at CERN, we're seeing 50, 60 organizations that collaborate with us deploying OpenStack as well. And we're also starting to look at use of public cloud resources outside of CERN. Clearly, if we carry on growing, we need to find ways under which to be satisfying that capacity requirement. So CERN has an organization that allows us to do collaboration with industry, the CERN Open Lab. And during one of the summits, we had some discussions with Rackspace, where we clearly identified a common interest in solving this problem. So in October last year, Rackspace joined the Open Lab collaboration. And then with that, we set off to solve this problem. The code for this is not research. It's now in the production release. The server came out with Icehouse. The clients came out with Juno. People can now be deploying federated identity on OpenStack. At the same time, this is clear technology change. But the cultural change in many ways is worse, is a larger problem. We have people who can accelerate very fast, understand rapidly the techniques that can be used. On the other hand, we also have people for whom the applications they're running, some of these techniques don't appear so relevant. And it brings us back to Hooke's law, which is the law that says you can expand a spring to a certain level under load, but then eventually it deforms. And it is key that while we focus a lot on the progress that you get on the one side of the spring, that you make sure that the tension doesn't get such that you reach that point. So focus on the new technology, but also keep in mind that there will be some people for whom they need a little bit of persuading. So how do we go about doing this? We assembled a small team, and it really was of this sort of size. It consisted of a mixture of experienced people who'd been running services before, and a set of new hires. Naturally, CERN has a certain rotation of staff. Many contracts are short-term. These people came in with basic Linux skills, and then leave CERN knowing Puppet, OpenStack, Elasticsearch Kibana, they don't spend very long before they find new job opportunities. And with this team, we then went through the process of building something that we could show people. Demonstration is an extremely forceful technique. However, a number of people came up with thoughts, and to be clear, these are rather extreme examples of how people react. There were the people that felt it was going a little bit too fast. They wanted to take things more slowly. And we have a fixed window. The LHC starts up again in April next year. The transformation had to be done by then. In fact, this week, while we are here, they've just started dismantling the old configuration management system that we were using. At the same time, there were the people whose services were organized in silos. This means they had the budget, the staff for the entire service. Now, to turn around to them and explain that, now, please give us your budget, and here is a quota on the cloud, is a major cultural change.
Okay, listen carefully now, because he's about to describe the learning outcome of this course.
We had the experienced service managers who had been running services for a long period and were finding that the people who were joining their teams actually had been taught Puppet and OpenStack in university. And they were saying, you're doing it all wrong, you should do it this way. And actually we had a skills inversion where rather than the new joiners sitting next door to the specialists and understanding how to do the tools, we're finding the new people explaining the more experienced ones the best way to go. New joiners doing their teams actually have been
Once
taught
again.
Puppet and open saying, you're doing it all wrong, you should do it this way. And actually we had a skills inversion where rather than the new joiners sitting next door to the specialists and understanding how to do the tools, we're finding the new people explaining the more experienced ones the best way to go.
So you should be one of these students that come out, know Puppet, OpenStack, and all these tools, and know how to treat infrastructure as code.
And then finally, we have the people for whom their servers are precious. They have something where what they want is a unique configuration that you can't get from anywhere else. Now, in many cases, these requirements can be justified, and it involves a large amount of consulting and discussion to work out the right balance between implementing consistent environments and implementing specialized configurations that potentially cost elsewhere in the organization. So, when I look back at how science has evolved, Newton wrote a letter to Hooke, the guy that wrote the string theory, where he talked about dwarves standing on the shoulders of giants. And science evolution has been on this basis. Each person makes a small progress. The next person takes over, builds on top of that to get further. Large collaborations like we have around the LHC, the Atlas collaboration is around 2,000 people. These communities get together, work on the basis of transparency, meritocracy, and a shared vision. When we look at the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee started off and had a very nice text line browser. He didn't feel that embedded graphics was really something that was needed. Now, if we'd been in a situation where the only browser selected was the one that Tim wanted, we'd probably still have a basic text interface. We might still be ending up on Internet Explorer 5 as the only browser that we could use. However, what we have now is a hugely vibrant ecosystem, which is based on some solid core APIs and allowing healthy competition in other areas. So in summary, thanks to all of you for your efforts. When you do helping on an OpenStack, so when you're contributing code, finding patches in documentation, when you're working through with others on the mailing lists, when you're coming to meetups such as this, giving feedback on the user survey, just remember that along with helping out OpenStack, you're helping us understand how the universe works and what it's made of. Thank you very much.
Okay, let's break for 15 minutes. Okay. Yep. Yep. Just so you know that this presentation is from 2014 or 13 or something. He said that there four OpenStack clouds is around 75,000 cores. There is an updated version at this is from a talk he gave in just 2 months ago. And you see that now they're past 200,000 cores, additional 60,000 cores. So this is actual physical CPU cores that they have in their cloud, and OpenStack is now powering 90% of CERN's compute resources. So just so you have the updated numbers. You are familiar with, some of you are familiar that we have these information security lectures every Friday. And the last Friday of every month, we have a sort of a more special lecture, which we call NIS lecture, Norwegian Information Security Lecture. Every Friday, every other Friday, there's a seminar in the kitchen, which you are welcome to attend if it's an interesting topic for you. But the last Friday of every month, we have this more formal lecture in the auditorium. And on the last lecture in September, so in 4 weeks, the head of the security group in the IT division at CERN is coming to give the lecture. So that will be interesting. Then you hear more about the security aspects at CERN as well. Okay, so as I said, I really want you to be the guys that graduate and guys and girls who graduate and know Puppet and OpenStack and how to realize services in the cloud in a professional way using best practice methods. So what we need to do then is first let's start to use OpenStack. Let's use the cloud manually. Some of you have done this before, many of you have not. So that's what we're doing tomorrow, is getting started with the practical stuff. Logging in, starting servers, creating a router, setting up the network. That's the lab exercise tomorrow. And tomorrow, there will be one or two other guys here for the first 2 hours from 10 to 12. Egil from my office and probably Lars Erik from the IT service. Lars Erik is the one in charge of our OpenStack cloud, and Egil is the architect of it, so they know pretty much this better than I do. But they will be here for the first 2 hours because I have to be in a meeting, and then I'll be here from 12 to 2. So that's getting going with OpenStack and command line usage. That's the first thing we do. And logging in, making sure that you know how to use SSH. Unfortunately, we're still on IP version 4. And IP version 4 addresses, we don't have a lot of them. So we have to do some tricks to access our servers, doing some port forwarding and some proxy usage. Which is also things we have to start up doing this week, tomorrow. So tomorrow, make sure you just do practical work and ask any kind of basic question at any time in the course. So that's basic. Then we want to see how can we orchestrate a scenario. So what is an infrastructure? You will not learn anything in this course about how to install and set up OpenStack. If you want to do that, if you want to learn that, that's by all means, I recommend it. Do it on your own computers or do it in the lab here. Maybe you do it as part of your bachelor thesis if you want to. But you know, installing cloud software on hardware, it's a lot of work. That's not where all the work is in the future. So if you want good jobs, you know, working with getting cloud software going on hardware and installing it in the data center, this is pretty standard stuff. This is technical, and a lot of people are good at doing it. By all means, become one of those people if you want to. If you like working with hardware, do that. But where is all the business? Where is all the jobs? It's realizing the services in the cloud. It's using the cloud. And the good thing now is that a lot of companies are standardizing on using OpenStack. It's not just CERN. If you want to use IBM's cloud, the Bluemix, it's based on OpenStack. Rackspace, of course, is OpenStack. And several of these services, Microsoft Azure is not OpenStack. There are other clouds as well, but they're similar in usage. Amazon is also similar in usage, and some of the API to Amazon is compatible with the OpenStack API. So it shouldn't be very difficult for you to switch to a different cloud provider if it's not OpenStack based. But OpenStack is probably the biggest one and the most open one and the natural for one for us to learn. So our goal is that you have a company that you are consultants. And a company says that they contact your firm and you're given the task of this customer needs this kind of infrastructure because they need a high capacity online website for selling tickets to something or similar. So a typical infrastructure for serving this would be something like this, where you have a whole bunch of load balancing at any level. You have some web servers, you have some application servers, and you have the back-end database servers, and this has to scale, and you should easily be able to deploy more of these as needed. In fact, it should probably happen by itself based on how much traffic is received and so on. But you know, just 10 years ago, you would then start writing, spending a lot of time writing down a requirement specification for what you need to buy of physical equipment for this. Now you just log into Amazon, you upload a template file that describes this infrastructure, and within 1 hour you have it up and running. It's quite amazing. 10 years ago this would take you 6 months and fighting with your boss and everything to get all the money, and you know, now it's really easy to set this up. So describing this, that's called orchestration. Know, composing all the services together in a network, describing what the setup should be, if which servers should have how much memory and how many CPUs, how much storage, all of this, that's orchestration. And that for orchestration, we either use YAML or we use JSON. You can either use YAML or JSON. The OpenStack component which does this is called Heat. So we describe the infrastructure using a Heat template, which is YAML, which is a very simple markup language. So that's why we're only spending 1 week on this, because this isn't very hard. But that's the first part is describing this orchestration. Then we move on to the key part of the course, which is learning the language of Puppet, and learning how to use Puppet in a professional manner. Meaning what we're going to do is that, of course, when you manage servers, you don't do changes, you never do changes in production. If a company has a business, the business is online, it's in production, and you're in charge of making changes. How do you do that? Well, you try to do the changes, you test and you test and you test, and when you're absolutely sure, you move it into production. And with the cloud, this is really easy. You can test, you can automate all these steps, make sure everything works, and move it into production. And what we used to do is, and what the old style companies still do, is that you make upgrades like 4 times per year, or once a month, or 2 times per year, something like this. A modern DevOps company maybe makes upgrades 10 times per day. Because the entire process is so pipelined and everything is so carefully tested automatically, and then you want small rapid changes instead of these big manual changes that you've tried to test the best you can once a month, you know. But errors still happen, of course. So we orchestrate with the language, but then we need to fill our infrastructure with content and maintain that content. And that's what we use Puppet for. So we learn the language of Puppet 1 week. Then we learn about how Puppet modules, how they are. And you're going to write a Puppet module. That's probably the most difficult thing you will do in this course, is that you have to write an actual Puppet module. But that's the best way to learn exactly all the intrinsic details of Puppet. And I hope you find it motivating and rewarding, but you also will probably find it a bit frustrating that you will have to learn a lot of details in Puppet. So Puppet is a language, and you know, learning a language, that's not that hard. But remember that Puppet is a language for managing all kinds of IT systems. So it's kind of hard to learn the language without knowing a bit about all these IT systems that you're going to manage. So the language itself is pretty high level. Actually, I can show you an example, because I did this yesterday. So you're going to get user account from me, and you're also going to use your NTNU identity. Ideally, you should only use your NTNU identity, but one of the many things we haven't had time to do is integrate the SSH login into our server, into the NTNU system yet. But Sky High, the graphical login, is now integrated. So when you log into Sky High, I'll show you all this later, you use your NTNU identity. So, but yesterday, I created accounts for you. And to create accounts on a server, just creating local accounts, we do something like this. Well, so, sorry. So I would run and this is basically, I expect you to be able to understand this roughly. You don't have to write a lot of shell scripts, but if you are familiar with Linux, this shouldn't be much magic. So I have a for loop. I'm going to create 50 users. User 01, user 02, user 03. And then, so I iterate over 01 to 0 to 50. And then I create a password. I say simply I can use pvgen, say I'm going to create one password with 12 characters, not the highest security, but decent. I want you to be able to easily remember it as well. So this password, create a password, and then I echo user 0102, etc. And then this, because I'm going to copy and paste this into a script. So this is just two characters. And then I create the hash of the password, so I can insert it directly into the password database. So this creates a hash of the password and outputs that with a comma, and then I write the password in clear text. And that's done. So if I run this, see, I get 50 users with their password hash and their actual password. By the way, and of course, this is then every time I run this, I get a different password. So that's why I'm showing you the password in clear text. This is not anyone's password. So I do this. And for the script I showed you, let's see. So the umask variable, so that the home directories are created without access for the others. Just a default, the umask environment variable decides when you the default permissions on files you create. And then I pipe this data I just created into a loop, and I print some output, and I do a user add in the home as the basis with the bin bash shell with this password and this username. So that would be a way to do. But then, okay, I create hundreds of users maybe with this script. And then some users, it fails. Okay, what do I do? I can't run the script again because I already created these users. So this is an imperative script. It focuses on how you do it. And when I've done it once, maybe everything is successful, maybe not. Okay, so if I want this to be robust, maybe I should have some if statements checking if this user exists, etc., etc. Meaning I want to be able to run this again and again and again without problems. So if something fails, it should be fixed on the next run. Anyone from the operating system course know what we call this property? To be able to run something again and again. If it's correct, just stay correct. If it's wrong, then fix it. Idempotent. And when you do system administration, you want this property all the time. And that's why we use Puppet. Because Puppet has idempotent by default. And that's why we're first going to spend time on learning Puppet. Then, when we switch to Windows, we're going to use the idempotent version of PowerShell, which is PowerShell desired state configuration, which was actually in the news this morning, I think. Who read about PowerShell desired state configuration on Slashdot this morning or yesterday? Yeah, it was yesterday. Latest Windows 10 update breaks PowerShell. According to a report via InfoWare, latest Windows 10 update breaks desired state configuration functionality in PowerShell. But it's in Windows 10. It's not in any of the Windows servers. And desired state configuration, you'd use that on servers. For configuring Windows 10 clients, you would probably still use good old group policy. We're not going to go into group policy, but I have material on that if anyone wants to learn it or something. But PowerShell desired state configuration is sort of Puppet for Windows. But it's really not very mature yet. So when you're going to manage Windows computers, you would either you go for PowerShell desired state configuration, or you actually use Puppet on Windows. And then Puppet has a separate module that means you can sort of write desired state configuration code into your Puppet configuration. And it's quite nice. And then Microsoft also supports PowerShell desired state configuration on Linux. So you can also choose to use PowerShell desired state configuration and not use Puppet at all, and use this for also managing Linux. But this is really not very mature. But it's sort of on the demo stadium. But it is possible. But both these technologies, that's the main focus for this course, because this is idempotent languages. That's the key for doing good system administration. Where was I? Oh, I was here. Sorry. Yeah. So this is not idempotent. If I do this, so that's what I did yesterday, because writing a script like this was a bit clumsy to do in Puppet last year, in Puppet version 3. But Puppet version 4, which is what we're going to do, introduced some missing language features, making iteration especially much easier. So last evening I rewrote this script. I finally did this as Puppet code. Who is a BI expert here? How do I disable this? Anyone know? Sorry. I have too much automatic setup. Sorry, let's just do this instead. So this is the same code. They're doing the same thing, but in Puppet. So I simply say there should be a group. There should be a user. And the user's home directory should have these permissions. And the group has to exist before the user. So that's why I create a link to this resource there. And the file, I can't set permissions on a file before it exists. So this has to be done after this. And so here I just pasted this all the usernames and the password hashes in here in the hash. And then this was introduced with Puppet 4. This is a lambda function, in case anyone have used or heard about lambda functions, an unnamed function, sort of an unnamed ad hoc function. But this allows me to iterate over this hash, and then I use these two variables as pairs throughout the hash, and I say create this group, create this user, create this file. And by default, if they exist from before, and they are as described here, then Puppet say, fine, just leave them. So that's what we're going to spend some weeks on. So 1 week learning the language, 1 week learning about modules, 1 week doing an actual setup of a distributed with a main Puppet master server and Puppet agent on different virtual machines, and having an actual Puppet setup. Then we should have learned all the basics of Puppet, and we do an exam. After the exam, we go on and we introduce the right workflow. Then we start using Git. So we write our Puppet code. We create branches. We create a production branch and a testing branch and more branches, if you will. And then we use a special program in Puppet called R10K, which retrieves configuration from Git and creates Puppet environments mapped to Git branches. And this is really, really cool. And then you can automatically have a testing infrastructure and a production infrastructure, all based on Git. Then we're sort of, this is where we have reached our goal. Then we know Puppet and we know the workflow. So then let's apply this on two scenarios. One on creating a logging infrastructure. And this is the Elk stack. So let's use Puppet to deploy the Elk stack, which is Elasticsearch, Logstash, and Kibana. You heard Tim Bell talking about it. Which is something that we really have to know to gather all logs and have it in one place so we can easily both search and debug errors and we can investigate security incidents, etc. So, and when we deploy this with Puppet, it doesn't matter if you deploy it on 10 machines or on 1,000 machines. Because Puppet just distributes it and does it for you. That's why you use some configuration management system. And then we're going to apply it on a monitoring system. I haven't quite decided if we use it with Ezinga 2 or if we switch to using Sensu. It doesn't really matter that much, but some monitoring system. So here we know what we're going to do. We apply it on two cases. Then we switch to Windows and transfer our knowledge into PowerShell desired state configuration. And use PowerShell desired state configuration on Active Directory and on Exchange. That's the goal. And then you have a project where basically I'm going to propose a bunch of topics, but if you have something you want to roll out and configure and set up, any kind of architecture, any kind of system you would like to deploy in the cloud, this is your chance. So here you should, in your project, you should demonstrate that you know what you do, or you know what you're supposed to have learned, something like that. Yeah. So do something with orchestration, Puppet, and or desired state configuration. If you want to spend the project on really digging into PowerShell desired state configuration, you can do that. If you want to just stay with Puppet, you can do that. But this is sort of to do a case study, implement something on your own. Feel free to choose what you want, but I'll help you with some ideas. Okay, so how do we get going? I've talked about getting going. Okay, so this is 21 pages. These are the first 5 weeks. This is what you should do, and as I said, week 4 and 5 is probably much more than 1 week. So be prepared that these weeks are quite hard. So if you can move more rapidly than the first 3 weeks, that's also good. So I think everything you need to know is in here. You need to, if you're not on, sorry, I haven't searched and replaced completely HIG, this is NTNU, of course. So if you're not on the network here, you need to use VPN. And you might need to use VPN on some of the networks here as well. Because we have a very carefully set up network with security and access rules. Sometimes you need VPN even though you can use, it might be useful to use VPN even though you are on the network. So make sure you have a laptop with working VPN. I'm not quite sure how this works for you. Maybe you know, because some of you, I'm sure, use VPN. Do any of you use the VPN from NTNU, the one called SSL VPN? Yep. So, yeah. Because I tried this last night, because I hadn't read the news. And by the way, you don't have to have a laptop with Linux. You can have a laptop with Mac or Windows if you will. You just make sure your laptop, you need to set up VPN. And there should be instructions on the web how you do this. Like what I do is I have go to my... Why are these grayed out? Huh? Okay. Yep. The you probably need to install this Cisco AnyConnect client and then access vpn.hig.no. Yes. Yes, that's what I'm, yeah. Open Connect you can use as well. That's what I'm using also. Mm. You have to use the old one. So I tried the NTNU one yesterday, but it didn't work for me. So I thought maybe for students it's ready, but it's probably not ready for students either. So students should also use the vpn.hig.no. Okay. Then when we access Windows computers, we need to use remote desktop. On Windows, you can use this built-in client. Remote desktop connection, which you can start from the command line like this. On Mac, you should probably install the Microsoft Remote Desktop Connection from the App Store. That's the client that works best on Mac. And on Linux, you can use R Desktop. This is the command line that I use. Yeah. So here are some tricks that... Yes? Great. .stud.hig.no. Yeah. So just read through this. Some of these tricks you will see that you will might use or might need later. Like there's an error you probably get on the Ubuntu virtual machines when you use them that you can fix with these commands, etc. So, here I say, connect to Sky-Hi with SSH and start a screen session. So, skyhi.hig.no. That's your cloud. And what you can do, what you actually can do now, if you want to, is to... skyhi.hig.no. You should end up here. And you should be able to log in with your username and password. But you probably get an error message saying that you're not allowed to do anything, or you have no quota, or you have no project. Except for two of you, which should be able to log in and have access. So our OpenStack cloud is called Sky-Hi, and it has a graphical user interface, and it has a command line user interface. And you will be using both. So... If I log in, of course, Someone tried to log in and get an error message or something. What does it say? But Christopher or Torstein, you're able to log in. Yeah. So the thing is, you can log in here and you can do all the stuff here. This is useful because you can always come in here to get an overview. So we want to use the command line because then we can automate and do things rapidly and, you know, all the benefits of the command line. But we also want to combine that with the benefit of the graphical user interface. And the graphical user interface is nice when we want an overview. So this is, I haven't quite decided what kind of quota you will get. Probably you will get what I have now, that you can create 15 virtual machines and that you have access to 30 gigabytes of RAM, etc. But we will see how many, because Sky High, he has limited capacity. We have, you know, Tim Bell, he had 200,000 cores. We have 72 cores. And we have about 600 gigabytes of RAM in total. Meaning, if I give each of you 30, then we just 20 students and it's full. Well, that's not true because I can over-provision by a factor 2. But if you're 40 students and you all use 30 gigabytes of RAM, then the cloud is pretty much full. But we are hopefully installing more capacity within a few weeks. But maybe worst case, I will have to ask you to join together in groups, two and two or something, and work together on the same machines. We'll see. But notice here, in Sky High, you can watch your running servers. You can, especially here, network topology. Here you can see your setup. So I'm working on preparing the rest of the course for you. And this is what you will be working with. You see, these are your servers. This is a switch. These are routers and servers connected to a switch and a router. We will not use a very advanced scenario. This is pretty much where we will be working. But this here is launched as a heat template. So this, you will get to this quite quickly. What I suspect, so the good thing is that when you go log into Sky High, sometimes you lose network connection to your host, or you wonder, why can't I access my host using SSH? What do you do in the physical world then? Well, you bring a terminal and a keyboard to the server and you plug it in and you access the console of the server. Or you use some DRAC or ILO system so you can access console. And that's what you can do here. And that's what you maybe have to use VPN for, even though you are here. So I suspect that if I try, so for instance, I wonder, is this server here, is there something wrong with it? I want to watch the console for the server Kramer. I can click on it, open console. And, yep, it's not working. If I had connected by VPN, this would work. It's almost, yeah. So, I don't know why I can't connect to VPN, but if I were connected by VPN, you would get the console here. And then you can see what the actual server looks like, and same as you would plug in a terminal into it. So you can use this for console access. When you create the heat orchestration, you also get this really nice or really frustrating figure like this. That says something about more details about everything you have created. Yeah, I'll get back to that. Okay, so here you will be able to log in, but I've only given quota to two of you. I will give it to the rest of you before tomorrow. Because I need to give you an account on the SSH server and assign you a quota in Sky High. And I have this setup ready. So, because what you will do tomorrow is that you will SSH to skyhigh.tig.no. And the workflow you should use when you enter here is that you should start a screen session. How many know how to use a screen? Probably. That's approximately the same as screen, isn't it? But more fancier and newer. Yes, good. Yes, I'm old-fashioned in some sense. So if you have a newer, more modern thing, then please do use that. So I always log in, and then I reconnect to all my working stations. So I say screen, reconnect, but usually I have to detach and then reconnect, like this. And then I have my working scenarios here. So Control-A-D, I disconnect from my screen session, and log out, and I'm done working. So you log in by SSH, and this is where you're supposed to run the OpenStack commands and create things, and then you can watch in the graphical user interface what happens. So that's what we'll do tomorrow. We will exercises that are here. So connect to Sky High, familiarize with OpenStack, and then create a key pair, create a network. All the commands are here, etc. But as I said, you need an account. So I will go on. That's what I'll do for the rest of the day and tomorrow morning, because I have to do this manually. So make sure that you are registered for the course. What I will do is that I have this list of participants. It says that there are 44 people here, and then there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people who are not students, including myself. So according to this list, I have 38 students, and that's approximately how many we are in the room right now, I think. We are 36 or something. So for all students on this list, I will use this username, and I will create, I will assign you a quota, and I will create a local user, and you will be user 0304, something like this, and a password. And I will give you your username and password in Fronter. So what you should do tomorrow morning, if you're wondering, do I have an account? Go in Fronter to innleveringer, hand-ins, it's probably called in the English version, here, and you see a folder, username and password. Click on this, and you should find your username and password. Because what I do is I go there, and then I choose each and one of you, and I hand in on your behalf, so it has a title with a username and a password. So there you should find your username and password that you need to access Sky High. Okay. So Egil and Lars-Erik, they will be here tomorrow at 10:15, and I will come approximately at, I will be here at 12:15. Okay, see you all tomorrow. Hmm.